closer.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
To clap now because it's all going into the thing.
See, you know, you're using the great product made by Tascam and everything works. It's amazing. Should have been doing this a long time ago.
Hey, look, baby, we get there eventually.
Baby steps.
Better late than never.
Better cheap than never. Welcome. Hey, something just fell out of your ceiling, I think.
Yeah, it's an old building.
How old is this building?
Oh, I think it was built in the 50s, roughly. Apparently, this building was originally studio housing for, I think, MGM, way back in the old days of Hollywood.
So we can see the ghosts of all, like, the contracted actors who suddenly were making, like, terrible money, and then were given a 10-year contract to make a million films.
Yep.
And then weren't renewed those contracts, and they didn't know what to do with their lives.
Yep.
I think that's, like, Ronald Reagan's story. not even joking. Hey, welcome to Two Magicians. It's the second episode of The Cliffhanger. What are we going to talk about? What did we forget?
I'm Simon Coronel.
I forgot my name, Nick Paul.
It's okay. The worst things to forget.
So we were talking about teaching, magic teaching theory. You just showed me a very funny comic panel of, we were talking about, you know, working something to death and not being excited about it. And just being done with it, and that one you just showed us. How did it starts off? I made this thing.
Oh yeah, my work is good, and the guy's looking at a frame that has the word "good" in it, just on a blank background. And he goes, "But panel two is. But I'll keep adding to it." And you see him starting to like draw additional things around the word "good," and then the last panel, now above the word "good," is not as his work is not as good because he kept adding to it when it was good.
Yeah. Sometimes you got to know when to stop.
Yeah, and that's often, I mean, we were talking about that with software right now. I've got, I'm trying to use this damn iOS, I just updated my iOS, the latest version.
Congratulations.
And a lot of things are worse now because they just changed them for no apparent good reason because of this temptation. Oh, we've got to keep changing. We've got to keep adding. We've got to do more stuff, even if it doesn't make it better.
With this, the problem is they changed it for the iPhone X and the XR and all that stuff.
Hmm.
So it's still kind of similar because you're on a 7 or what is that, a 7 or 6?
6S. Yeah. I'm old school.
This is boring information, but I feel like they're doing that so you get fed up with it and then look at the new model and realize, oh, these changes make sense on this model.
They really don't, though. It's just a less intuitive UI. There's no save button. It's just the UI does not indicate to you what is about to happen when you perform actions on it.
They think you're more intuitive than you are.
I think they're just idiots. Like, I think they're just changing stuff for the sake of changing it rather than making better.
Yeah. Well, they've run out of ideas.
They really have.
They'll reinvent themselves. It'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, Steve Jobs will come back to life in the body of someone and it'll be great.
He's just going to have one of those heads that they have in Futurama and then he'll start controlling the company.
That'd be great. Bring it.
I think,
hell yeah.
I think it'd be very changed. Nothing to do with magic, but side thought there. We're talking about magic teaching theory. What were you said you had a whole
I have so wide many thoughts thing. On magic teaching theory. So I enjoy performing magic, as we know, a lot. I enjoy teaching it more than that. I enjoy teaching more than performing magic because I got into magic. This is one of those meta topics of what's the core of the reason why you're doing a thing? A lot of people are in magic because they want to be admired or they want attention or they want, absolutely can relate to that, but that's not the core. For me, you know, a lot of people get into magic because you're shy and awkward and want a way to stand out from the crowd.
Yeah,
that's probably the most common one reason people get into magic. For me, I'd be lying if I said that wasn't an element as well way back when, but the core of why I got into magic was just absolute fascination with it. It was the most fascinating, bizarre thing I had ever encountered in my life, and I wanted to understand it. I've always been a truth seeker. I want to know the truth behind things. I want to understand them. I want to really get what's going on with anything, anytime.
And side note, it's fascinating to me when I meet a magician who isn't like
that.
Yeah. Because I've met a lot.
Yeah.
And it's a very different brain. Yeah.
And they just want that rush of that power, that bullshit, whatever. And then we don't get along well, and that's all right, because everyone's different.
I'm interesting because I kind of started that way and I've transitioned over to your way of, I need to know how all this works. And it's different.
And it's the innate fascination. And one of the things is being fascinated to discover, like two very admirable human qualities are, and this is obviously a very self-serving belief, full disclosure, but the desire to learn and discover and then the desire to share those discoveries and things you've learned.
Mm.
And I think those are two very healthy things for an individual and a civilization. That's how things get better. You want to figure things out, and then you want to share what you've learned with everybody else, assuming they're into it. Right.
Well, that's how humans got to. We are the only species that is able to learn from past
exactly.
generations.
And learn from, learn from each other completely. And so with magic, at age 18, I saw my first close-up magic trick that, in an accessible context where I could actually ask questions about it. And it was amazing. I just visceral, deep desire to learn more about it, to really understand what everything behind what I'd just seen. I find it so hard to relate to people who don't want to know the secrets of magic. I think that's a bizarre way to respond to something. Yeah, but
people
will
walk into the castle very often and go, I don't want to know. I don't want to know. And that's great as an audience member because they're on your side.
I cannot relate to those people in any way. And it's been very genuinely difficult for me to learn to still respect those people. and that's a failing of me, right? That's absolutely my failing. They absolutely are worthy of respect.
Sure.
I had to learn that.
Well, it's the same people that for me, say that, you know, they believe in astrology.
Yeah.
Like, it's
see, that,
no judgments, but it's like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, people who don't actually care about the real, actual, objective truth behind things.
Yeah.
Don't want to really think about stuff or discover stuff. Or people who are like that, but just want magic can be their one escape. And that was where I eventually found the happy medium with being okay with that was someone equated it to not wanting spoilers for a TV show. It's not like it matters. Like, magic is something that doesn't really actually matter in the scheme of things. So if some people just want that to be their recreational thing they don't question, all right, okay, I guess that's not so bad. But hey, anyway, this is all largely beside the point. That's a very separate thing. My
Simon
journey
Cornell
to
opening up on his judgments of other people.
And that's the thing, it's 100% on me. That is absolutely on me, not on them. It's just a thing I've struggled with.
Yeah. Well, I was like that too.
I cannot
because
relate to that at all.
Yeah, I mean,
you might not want to know the story behind something.
I used to be very judgmental of people with different, you know, religious beliefs, and it was like, how can you? What? How can you believe it? And you realize that everybody, you know, whatever puts points in your pontoon, whatever gets you through the day, as long as it's not hurting other people, there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah.
So that's a whole other realization you have to come to yourself, I think.
But there's also the dangerous extra layer of even if that isn't hurting people, the underlying mindset that leads them to be that way
might be resulting in other things
that hurt people, particularly with religion
and
bigotry. That
opens a whole can of worms. And
then
you just become Richard Dawkins, and I don't want to become Richard Dawkins because he's mad at everything.
God, yeah.
I'm like, I agree with you, but you're so angry and nobody likes you.
Man, that guy is his own worst proponent. Evangelist. Like, he's the worst person actually spreading his own message.
Yeah.
So actively, violently counterproductive to his actual goals. Which I think are admirable, but man's an asshole.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah.
So
this isn't the religion podcast. This is the magic.
And this is why
podcast.
I love doing magic, because through doing magic is it's the only way to really understand it, first of all. You can't really understand something like magic without doing it and living it and learning deeply from it over years and decades. And I love doing it because it's a way to connect visually with this thing that I find more fascinating than any other one thing I've learned about in the world. You know, the solar wind hitting the magnetosphere to produce the solar wind.
Oh, was that a callback to the episode we did 2 weeks ago?
That was the one. Is fascinating to me. Like, that's so good. I'm fascinated by it, but magic is so much more fascinating than anything I've learned about. So by performing it and doing it, I connect with that. And yes, there is also the rush of a performance. There is the rush of doing a difficult thing. It's the flow theory again, much like last Fortnite or whenever it was 2 weeks ago, that flow state, it's difficult but not so hard, I can't do it, and it's this rush of creative and challenge and everything, and that's all great. But when teaching magic, one of the frustrating things about performing magic is the audience only gets to experience the tiniest tip of the iceberg of what you're actually doing and what you've actually done to get there. Like, all the work and the theory and the psychology and the subtlety and the nuance and the practice and how hard it is to learn those moves and how those moves can be used to create completely counterintuitive effects. It's amazing, and that's what I'm in love with magic. It's the whole picture, but the audience sees us the surface of that. They only see the effect. They don't see the method and the ingenuity and the history of behind all these things. There's the whole, you know, 9/10 of the iceberg is hidden from them of what actually went into this show. That's true of any show, theater, music, but at least with those things, you can let the audience behind the scenes. You can have the making of featurette. You can have the chit-chat. And people with music and theater, they at least get that, yeah, there's rehearsals. You have to learn scales before you can play guitar. With magic, they have no idea about even the tiniest fraction of the whole picture. And that's frustrating because I have that intuitive human urge. I want to share. I want to share the amazing stuff I've discovered and experienced and learned and seen. And it's like, it's become the primary thing in my life. Of course I'm into that. Of course I want to share the thing I'm into. But you can't because it's all hidden.
Tell us how you really feel.
I said I had
views.
Well,
that is the double-edged sword of magical tricks.
Yeah.
Because if you do expose that, then I think a lot of the people would go, oh, yeah. Well, that's it. And still have no appreciation for where it all came from and the thought process.
Yeah.
I think it just depends on the routine itself. But I like when a certain trick really has such a profound reveal to it.
Yeah.
When you reveal it to somebody, they go, oh, wow, I would have never thought of that.
Yeah. And there's that saying, I think this is another Teller quote. I may be wrong, but it's something to the effect of, if a person is disappointed at discovering the secret to a magic trick, that just means they haven't really understood what they've discovered. Because, and it's true, there is that layer that on the surface you go, wow, that trick's amazing. And you learn that the method is really simple, practically trivial. And the reflexive, naive reaction is disappointment. Oh, that's such a letdown. But then when you get deeper into that, when you really understand what you're actually looking at, you realize that it's brilliant. That's what's so brilliant. The fact that an apparently simple thing can achieve such a remarkable result. And then once you understand why and how it achieves that result, and how that what that says about human perception and cognition and our sense of reality and self and everything else, and once you really understand that whole picture, it's stunning and it's astounding and it's remarkable. And so the disappointment response is only means they haven't really seen what's behind the curtain. Yeah. They've only seen a little bit of it.
That's like them finding out that most of the Avengers was just a green screen. that wasn't real?
Yeah.
But with not realizing the time and effort and artistry. And,
yeah, to do good green screen work? And, and that's amazing.
And to legit take the audience to another world without them realizing.
Yeah, and the art and the craft and the nuance and the subtlety of that is fascinating.
It's not the same thing as a card-to-pocket routine, but I think there are similarities. And it is funny because that's something kind of neat to reference in the show of letting people know that there's a lot more layers to this than you actually realize.
Yeah.
And if you knew how it was done, you would be disappointed.
Yeah.
If you're looking at it incorrectly.
Yeah. But even that's still only even looking at the method to effect dichotomy. The fact that what is the effect? The coin vanished. What's the method? You dropped it in your pants or whatever. Like, just that obviously is already, but then beyond that,
he wasn't wearing pants.
The twist. You have seen my act. Okay.
Yeah, privately.
Yeah, that's a whole different one. The two Magicians, One Mic After Dark edition. 18 plus only.
What are downloads going on?
That could be the live tour, the midnight show. But beyond that, like even just things like what goes into packing to travel with a show, what goes into choosing the material, what goes into the fact that which card to pocket of the literally hundreds out there did you choose to work on, the history, the breadth of it, the number of different takes on it. Just all that stuff, the whole universe that is magic, the number of different methods that could be used to get that same effect, but you didn't choose, and why, and all of that thought and work and fascination and everything, like that is all so interesting to me and can't be shared.
So you're just overwhelming me now, and I feel like I haven't done enough research. you absorb this like a sponge, and it gives you comfort. For me, it gives me severe anxiety.
Yeah, but that's the thing, even if it's like, the difference between the way we work on material, right? The fact that they could see your show and then my show. And, of course, they would be oblivious to the fact that, like, the genesis of these two shows is a very different path. And, all of that as well is part of what's fascinating to me about this whole thing. And, again, doesn't get shared with an audience in a show. Because even if you could, it'd be boring and it wouldn't work and most of them wouldn't get it. Whereas, so back to the original topic, when teaching, I get to share the whole iceberg. And that is what I really love way more than sharing only the tip of the iceberg in a performance. In a workshop or a class, you can share the entire iceberg. You see the whole picture. You can get into all of the things that are actually fascinating and brilliant about this amazing art and craft.
I had this idea in my workshop to say, okay, I'm going to teach you these very simple tricks, you know, for like layman, not actual, you know, magician workshop. And then you get to ask me, I will reveal how one piece of the show is done in complete detail.
Hey, that's interesting.
Like, is that a stupid thing to do, or is that very intriguing? Because I'm like, if the small group of people, like I said, show up to the workshop from a theater of, you know, 800 or whatever, a couple hundred, maybe they deserve.
But
then you have to swear them to secrecy.
Yeah. The Institute of Audience Studies, try it and see. The only way to know is to try it.
Yeah.
And to get feedback on it. I have found that experientially, when you do explain, and really explain, not just trivially expose, but explain the whole iceberg, so to speak, of a trick to an audience, it usually increases their respect for and appreciation of magic as an art and craft. Usually. If you do it right and you go, now, here is why this works, here is the work that goes into it, here is, like, really explain it, not just, it's a thing under the thing. Yay.
I know what you're talking about. I stumbled upon that, and because I'm not a great teacher. I'm learning it, and I'm getting better. And you do these workshops on ships because when they ask you, hey, do you do a workshop? You say yes, because if you say no, then it goes back to the agent. Oh, he didn't have enough material.
Yeah.
Which has happened before. But I stumbled upon that where I was just going through a simple, like, false transfer of a napkin and just going step by step. Look over this way. If you're not looking this way, the audience is always looking where you are. Just like a little couple of details I hadn't normally put in.
Yeah.
Just because I'm like, they're kids. It makes no difference. But you saw all the parents kind of sit up and go,
completely.
Oh, wow, there's a lot more to this than I ever thought.
Which
this
is
stupid little disappearing napkin trick.
Which is my iceberg frustration.
Yes.
That, in a show, in a workshop, then you can actually really share the whole beautiful, amazing picture. And so it's just funny, again, this thing like last week, it's very subjective. Everyone has different things they like and dislike and are comfortable with and are good at. And I'm the exact opposite. When I get asked to teach a workshop, I get excited because, like, I'd much rather be doing that than doing a show in a heartbeat. Hell yeah. It's workshop time, mofos. Let's go. You know me. Anyone listening knows I could not be more hypercritical about my own work and everyone else's. Most of my shows I've done, I'm not super proud of. Like, they're good, they're fine, but they're frustratingly inadequate. I'm always annoyed at, this could be so much better. I need to work so much harder. My stage posture, my stage delivery, like talking speed on stage. Even now, I'm talking too fast. I know it's a problem. You know, hypercritical. Whereas I am really proud of my magic teaching skills. I'm really effing good at that. And that's a thing I would say about almost nothing I do, except I know I can teach the shit out of a magic class. So I enjoy doing it. It's something it's fun to do things you're good at and flex those muscles because it's hard. Teaching's difficult.
It is.
Particularly with magic.
Because, you'll show how one thing is done. All right, you got it? And then everybody's like, what?
Yeah.
And you just put it on the rubber band on your four fingers and jumps over together.
Done. Yeah. And having watched a lot of magic workshops, both live and on video and in whatever form over the years, most of them are terrible. Most of them are really badly taught, and which is understandable because teaching's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
Most people haven't learned how to teach. They haven't.
But really, like, when I would see something that wasn't taught very well or written very well, I would take that personally of like, maybe I'm not smart enough to get this trick.
Yeah.
When in reality, it's just not being taught.
Yeah.
Correctly.
If a student is failing to learn, it is always the teacher's fault.
Ooh, even when it's controversial.
Even when it's not. Like, even when it's even when it is actually the student, it's still the teacher's fault. Like, you have to put the onus on the teacher.
And this is in the context of magic teaching. We're not making a broad statement about LA teachers, right?
My heart bleeds. Here's another side note. I absolutely firmly believe that primary and secondary, educational teaching, pre-primary, whatever, from teaching kids age 0 to 18 is the absolute most important role in society, bar none.
Sure.
Way more important than doctors, way more important than anything, and it is the most tragically underappreciated and underrewarded role in society.
Yeah.
That is, I think, probably if there was one biggest flaw in society, it's that.
I wish it was harder to become a teacher. Not hard to become a teacher, but I wish it would, the process, because there's so many good teachers side by side with so many terrible teachers, and it's not fair to the good teachers.
Yeah, it's not.
I had several very good teachers in grade school, and then I think about all the higher number of not as good teachers because, you know, it's like the system is stacked against them in many cases of they do good or it's poorly. It doesn't matter. They just have to get these
because
test
skills. The system, particularly in the US, my God. And it's like it's bad in the UK and Australia as well. But in the US, it's horrifying how much they are hamstrung.
But going back to what you were just saying, it really does affect the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, it's heartbreaking.
And to the good teachers out there who actually give a damn and actually care, like, to me, genuinely, they are the greatest heroes in the world. Like, bar none. No one's even close second place to the teachers. Everything hinges on them. And they get so little respect and reward for it because it's so hard to teach
and
well.
It's like I get frustrated where I show up, like, a gig I regularly do, and I show up and I have a different manager than I did, and they act like, you know, I have to literally re-audition for them in this particular location that I've been at for 3 years. And I get frustrated by that, but I can't imagine that on a daily basis where you have one slip up in class and that's the time the principal's watching you or that's the time the superintendent is suddenly watching or paying attention.
And where the whole system is so deeply profoundly flawed. And I mean, and I love teaching and it's difficult and I think I'm good at it because I know how difficult it is and I like it and I care about it. And so I constantly experiment with ways to teach better. I've been doing that for like 10 years now, of like really getting into how do you teach? How do you teach well? What works? What doesn't? Let's try this. Did that work? Okay, no, that didn't work. Let's try this. Oh, that worked. Can we work? Yada, yada, yada. Again, the iterative process of learning anything. And I have the colossal privilege of teaching people who are interested in learning, whereas the elementary or secondary school teacher has to teach them whether they want to be there or not.
It's fun. You even see that in college now, too, where it's fascinating. That was the biggest surprise to me, going to college and paying all this money. You show up in a class where nobody wants to learn. I'm like, why are you here? Just go to a trade school or do something else. Why are you wasting your time and money and this teacher's time?
It's like the political systems of the first world are profoundly broken, but at least everyone realizes that. There's not enough attention on just in the mainstream public about how beyond broken the educational systems are, and I have no idea how to fix it because it seems to be an endemic flawed bias in human perception that they thank the doctors and the soldiers, but not the teachers, who are far more important to civilization.
I've met a lot, and I have... I won't go into details. I met a lot of doctors that are like, I could be a doctor. And there is people that are saving lives, doing amazing things, you know, doctors without borders, all that type of stuff is amazing. The same as caliber is teaching, where they're putting other people first and, you know, their passions first. But I've met, in my limited, you know, hospital experience, I've met people who are like, you? Oh, God.
But and that's the thing, in most... Never say all, because nothing's true of everything, but something I've noticed amongst most great teachers is it is always great teachers can adapt to the students, and that's the point. It's the job of the teacher to find a way to teach every unique individual student rather than because the student doesn't know anything about what the student doesn't know enough to how to adapt to your teaching style. Your job is to see what is this, how does this person learn, how could this person learn, what is this person struggling with, how do I guide them on their own journey? Because eventually everyone teaches themselves. The teacher can just guide them through the process of learning. You only learn through experience.
Yeah.
The teacher can just guide you through that experience and nudge you in the right direction and give you the info. And I love teaching. It's my favorite thing, particularly of magic. And so this gets to the back to when we were talking, whatever we were talking about last episode, I can't remember now. But something I think about a lot with teaching magic specifically is what I think of as the onion or the pearl or the oyster or the ogre, not the oyster. That's where pearls come from. Because most magic teaching goes like this. Here's a trick. Here's how it's done. Now do it a couple of times. Good. And it is only dealing with the method and effect dichotomy. Here's the here's the effect. Here's the method. Here's the effect. Here's the method. And that's because that's where most magicians stop thinking. And to some degree, then some lip service is often given to presentation. The third layer. Ah, presentation. Got to think about your patter. I'm going to paraphrase the late, great Eugene Berger here and go, the word patter should be stricken from the damn record. Because patter, if you look it up, what it means literally and the way it's used is irreverent, inane, idle chatter said to accompany something.
Yeah.
That's what the word patter means. Oh, he pattered along with the presentation. Burn that shit to the ground. Because most magicians, it is patter, and patter should be a dirty word. Referring to patter should be an insult. because that means it's not well thought out. It's not actually necessary or crafted or powerful or compelling. It's inane, idle chatter that is accompanying the trick. Because you had to say something, so you patter. Mm-hmm. Instead, you think about what is the presentation or what is happening in the performance, which might be nonverbal, like a lot of your work. It might be verbal, like whatever it is. So magicians sort of say, oh, go think about something to say while you do this. Mm-hmm. That's often the lip service.
As opposed to the thought of, is it necessary to say something here?
Yeah, and more importantly, let's give absolutely as much weight to that as to the effect and the method. Absolutely as much as that. But then more than that is, and here's sort of the, imagine like an layered onion, right? In the middle is the method. How do you do the thing? What's it? You pretend to put the coin into your other hand, but actually keep it back. And then how to make that look good. Like that's the method. Then the effect is the coin disappears, or the coin penetrates through the table, or the coin penetrates through your head, or your coin appears in your elbow. Because one method, as we know, can result in many different effects.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the method, which creates the effect, is the second layer. Then the third layer is the effect doesn't only exists within the context of the performance. And that's everything of what you're saying, how you're moving, what you're wearing, like what the lighting is like, what the sound background design, what's the set design, how do you greet the audience, what's your demeanor, what's your posture, what are your mannerisms, what's the intonation on every single word you say, what's the time, like everything, the whole
this
performance.
It's a free podcast.
Yeah. It's the real freaking deal. But yeah, everything about, not just what do you say with the effect, but no, let's look at the performance you're actually doing. When you get up, what's the first, you know, do you look at the audience before saying your first line? Do you say the first line before you look at them? Like everything, the whole actual performance without, you know, even without the method and the effect.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, the layer that then, again, I do this in the first class with a new student. All of this gets talked about from the beginning. That exists in the context of the experience. The performance that you're doing is wrapped in the experience the audience has. And that's the real thing our jobs actually are, is to create an experience for that audience, whether it's an individual buddy at a cafe over drinks or an audience of 1,000. The thing that matters, our actual thing we create, is the audience experience that our performance is part of. And that includes, how are they perceiving it? What is the venue? Did they pay to be there, or was this a show on a ship they didn't know to turn up for? A lot of the things we don't have control over, but as long as we're aware of them, we can craft the performance effect method to at least make that experience more likely to be better, and has the focus on that. Their experience is the thing that matters. And I explain this to the friggin' beginner in lesson number one. And the first trick I always teach is the breaking the coffee stirrer with a dollar bill. You know, the old thing where it's like, look, this folded bill can't break the wooden coffee stirrer that mm-hmm. you hold, and then snap, you do break it. Because it's the simplest trick that barely even has a method. Because the method is, you know, stick your finger out, as any magician readers will probably know. And I teach that because there's almost nothing to get distracted by about the method. Here's the method, now we're done. Now let's talk about the rest of the onion.
Hmm.
Let's talk about the whole damn onion of this trick. And how are you, Joe or Linda, who have turned up to this magic workshop, when you do this for your friends or family, what are all four of those layers going to be? Method, stick your finger out behind the bill. Great. Effect, dollar bill broke a coffee stirrer impossibly. Performance, right, how are you going to do this in a way that's different to every other person who would ever perform this trick? How are you connecting with the crowd? What's your personality? What's your opening hook? What are you saying? Are you going amped up and funny? Are you going low-key and mysterious? And everyone in the class has to do it differently. And they will, because we're all individuals. You can't do it the same way. So from the first lesson, they're encouraged to present it in a completely unique way to them. Even if it's only slightly different, but find out what it is about their performance. How are they going to deliver this to the crowd? What do they say? How do they greet the audience? When you get up, make eye contact with everyone. If it's an audience of several people, who are you going to bring up to hold the stirrer? How are you going to greet them? What are you going to say to them? Like the whole frickin' performance. And then around that, the final layer of the onion, the audience experience. What are these people experiencing of this performance? And making sure your focus is on that and crafting that for them rather than it being about you. Or, God forbid, just the method.
I'm so in my head about my show right now.
But anyway, that's the Coronel Onion theory of magic teaching for first-time beginners. Like, right from the start, I've never seen a magic teacher do this before. And it's the biggest thing that I think really works and I'm really proud of, because from the beginning, they're learning to really perform a trick properly to give an audience a good experience, which a lot of pro magicians don't even do. to be honest. Like, really thinking about all of that.
I'm just, like, picturing our friend with the initials KD. just his mind being blown right now. Just his face and everything. But, I mean, I think it's been helpful for anybody, I think, who's worked with you. It's been an immediate helpful thing.
Yeah.
And it's a great thing to put out there. And I have nothing to add to it because I'm not a natural teacher like you are. Yeah. But I think that's...
Well, but at this thing, I'm not even a natural teacher, right? That's only the result
passionate.
Of it.
Yeah, that's all you have to be.
And that's why, right?
If you're about passionate that aspect.
And you do it a lot and you think about it, you will slowly get good at it over a lot of time. And I've sucked. Like, first bunch of workshops I taught, I was terrible. Of course I was. I was new. I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But then slowly, because I was into it, sort of started learning and experimenting and noticing what worked and noticing what reached people. And there's a shitload of other theories I've got about magic teaching, but that's sort of the biggest one that I think has relevance to any magician teaching any non-magician magic at any point. That's something I really encourage everyone to think about because I think it gets a better result.
Yeah, and I think that can be applied to anything new artistic that you're learning.
It's
like having what's, besides learning how to paint the picture, what else goes into this?
Yeah, the whole onion rather than just the bit at the middle.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, you have to go on yet another plane to God knows where.
God, I know. Singapore this time.
Going straight to Singapore today?
Yeah, I'm going to Singapore in what time is it? It's 2 o'clock in 8 hours.
I flew from Detroit to Vegas to Burbank yesterday with my dog, and it was an hour and a half delay from the first flight, and I had 10 minutes to get from connection one to connection two. I ran. It was every stereotype you could think of. Furthest other gate from complete opposite end of Las Vegas Southwest Terminal. Old people getting off incredibly slow in front of me. The moving walkways were not moving. They were just walkways.
Wow.
And I'm like carrying my dog in a case because he just like had issues with his leg, so he can't like run with me. So I'm like carrying him and like bringing all my crap. And somehow we made it. And I was like, there's no way my bags made it. And I first thing I do right when I get off the plane is go right to baggage services. I'm like, hey, yeah, I don't think there's no way. So she starts putting up the report and she goes, wait, did you even check to see if your bags made it? I'm like, yeah, but there's no way in hell my bags made it. Fine, I'll go look. And sure enough, right as I walk out the door, I see them coming down the turnstile.
Wow.
I was like, all right, you guys are very good at your jobs.
You never know.
You're not good at leaving on time, Southwest, but somehow my bag always makes it with Southwest. It's amazing.
You know, it's a thing I've been thinking about a lot recently in the context of lots of things, that the concept is all of us are always wrong all the time about everything to some degree.
Yeah. And
right?
Being married, you are reminded of that all the time. Just when you think you're like, oh, why don't you know this thing? And then 10 minutes later, you make the same exact mistake you were, judging your spouse for.
Yeah.
And it's a great reminder of how yin and yang the universe is, and we don't even realize it.
But the thing is, to a lot of people, when they first hear that concept, you are always wrong about everything to at least some degree, even if it's 1% wrong. You're still always at least partially wrong. Most people find that really confronting and scary. Like, oh, God, no, I don't. Because we're told not to be wrong. We're told that it's wrong to be wrong.
Sure.
But the fact that we're wrong about everything all the time to some degree is actually exciting and liberating because we're even wrong about the bad stuff to some degree. Like, ugh, my bags are never going to have made it. Holy shit, I was wrong. Being wrong is actually often a beautiful, liberating, exciting thing because we're wrong about the bad stuff. We're wrong about the limitations.
I hate being wrong, and that's why I'm a solo performer, and that's why I really struggle with certain, directors and whatnot, and then it's like you said, it's very liberating when you're wrong and it's for the better, for the best.
And honestly,
you learn from that.
Often, like at least half the time, that's what it is. You are wrong for the better because now it doesn't surprise me anymore. Now I've become much better at embracing the always wrong mindset. Because thinking, what am I wrong about right now? Now the answer is everything. That's the point. Because
once you another episode,
yeah. But once you realize that's always the way it is, it stops being a problem because you go, well, yeah, of course, I'm wrong about everything. It's not, oh, no, am I wrong about something? Yes, you are wrong about everything.
The pressure is immediately gone.
Yeah, the pressure is gone. Yeah. The stigma is gone. So you go, all right, what am I most wrong about? And you start to try and work it out because you know it's everything. It's like, what am I wrong about? What am I thinking won't work? What am I thinking, oh, that'll never work, that I'm wrong about? What am I thinking?
But
sucks
what,
that I'm wrong
to play
about?
Devil's advocate.
Yeah.
The problem is anytime I'm confident about something.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, this is a surefire bet. Whatever it is, going somewhere, yeah. or some traveling or stage performance thing. That's when it falls on its face, and I lose my mind over that.
Yeah, but remember the counter devil's advocate is the point is there's a good chance you're only like 1% wrong about it, right? You're thinking this is going to be great, and it's very fractionally less great than you thought, but still great, mm-hmm. or it might be very fractionally more great than you thought. Like the point is, you're always there's no pressure to be exactly right about it. Everything's always uncertain to some degree. And as long as you stay open to that, you're more likely to notice possibilities for things to be better. And still wrong, but good wrong.
Be good wrong.
Damn right.
We have an episode called Be Less Worse. I like Be Good
That's
Wrong.
Right.
But this is more of a teaching episode, so it's kind of a bonus.
This was very much, I just didn't even notice the time. I went full rant earlier. It wasn't really rant, it was impassioned.
This is going to be one of the episodes something. People come up and go, I really love your podcast. And your friend who occasionally says one thing. But to be fair, like going back to the wrong thing, I know that what I say is not even close to the interesting things you say. So I just let you go sometimes. I know my weaknesses and I know my strengths.
Well,
and that is
also,
one of my
It's also
boats.
That thing about it's sometimes good to be reined back when if you're going off in a place that's interesting to people, that's great. I do one of the many things I'm very wrong about a lot is I often go off on things that people don't give a shit about. And everyone's thinking, shut up, Simon. As my mother would frequently tell me in my own best interest. Simon, stop talking.
And that's how you know she loves you. Oh, man. I probably should have had more of that growing up. My parents were very encouraging for better and for worse.
It's funny, isn't it, that happy medium of what's the right amount? Because it's like America generally errs on the side of too encouraging, and Australia generally errs on the side of too discouraging.
Yeah.
And there's that happy medium somewhere.
Yeah, it's tricky. I don't know that if I ever had kids, I don't know what I would do.
Yeah.
I don't know which angle I would play.
Well, it's
with
different
that.
For everybody. And it's, again, finding that yin and that yang of that kind of balance of every person. And again, the teacher has to adapt to the student. Every student needs a different way to be taught.
Mm-hmm.
They need a different amount of encouragement versus smacking the knuckles.
I was just reading, I'm blanking on what it was, an article or something about, I think it was a dad and the daughter, and he was letting the daughter do kind of anything. And you realize she had such a talent. I want to say it was gymnastics or something. Maybe it was dance, one of the two. And she wanted to quit that, like she'd quit everything else. And normally he'd be like, yeah, all right, you're done with it. Let's go to the next thing. But he went, no. You were too good at this to quit. And it was the first time that had ever happened. And it's playing that yin and yang of knowing when you're right and knowing when you have to push the kid versus letting them make the discoveries on their own.
Yeah. When do you draw that line in the sand?
It's tough. You're like legit good at this. You can't quit.
Ooh, that's a dangerous one.
Yeah.
Because that can lead to massive resentment 10 years down the track.
And that's not too far different from you saying that you do magic because you're good at it, and then you wanted to do something else. But you stick with magic because you're good at it. And then you know, good. Or it was clowning. I think that was the last episode we were talking about.
Clowning / improv. So all that stuff.
Yeah, so those are just the choices you kind of have to make as a person.
I'm pretty sure we talked about this on another episode, but the phrase that keeps coming back is that old saying about wishing for the strength to change the things you can, the temperance to accept the things you can't, and above all, the wisdom to tell the difference. And it's that third one I think about. Which one of these is this? Is this a situation where the right path is to suck it up and endure it? Or is this the time to stand up and say, no, I'm doing something about this? And you never know for certain.
I did that at the post office 2 days ago.
I'm
so
proud of
you. There. I was just trying to simply mail a thing, and it was... The man told me I couldn't. I had to pre-write it down, even though he was going to type it into the computer anyway. I'm like, okay, I'll get out of line. And there was nobody there when I showed up. But suddenly when I have to get out of line, get back in, five people. And he's going slow as molasses. And I'm like, do I freak out right now? Because I'm losing control of my own anxieties. Or do I just walk out and leave? And I walked out and left. And I went to UPS. Yeah. You know what? I paid the extra $5. And there was nobody in there. And the man was very friendly.
Yeah.
But
and that's the thing. It will always be, and the answer will always be different. That's one of my pet peeves is podcasts and videos and shit where people give advice. Here's how you because go screw yourself. Like everyone's path is different. Everyone's got different shit they're dealing with. Some people are dealing with different amounts of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Like some people are dealing with different hang-ups and issues and challenges, and like that. And that's I think one of the reasons I'm so passionate about teaching is even though I have been lucky to have some great teachers in my life, I've had so many terrible ones who couldn't teach me because I had some shit that I was dealing with, and I found it hard to learn. I'm a very slow learner, which is surprising to some people. But yeah, I'm a very slow learner. It is hard for me to really fully grasp a concept. It takes me a long time. Once I get it, I really get it.
Yeah, same.
And I was always one of the slowest kids in the class to really fit because I need to understand things from first principles. Otherwise, I don't really feel I understand them and I get confused and anxious.
Yeah, same. If I can't understand the foundations, it's not going to stick with. And like to me, it's like, well, what's the point of learning this if I'm not actually if it's not going to be absorbed inside me forever? What's the point of learning it now? Because it's just going to go away.
Yeah.
I felt like so much of grade school was that just rote memorization.
Yeah. And for me, throughout most of my life, most people who have taught me, whether actual teachers or just people who have given advice, which is a form of teaching, have not at all understood that I was finding it harder than they did because I needed a different level of granularity or I needed longer to grasp it or I was starting from further behind or whatever. And I think that's one of the reasons, you know, again, we become passionate about the things we ourselves suffered from and we want to prevent other people suffering the same things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of my pet people's advice of like, yeah, just go and do this. And I'm like, for me to do that, like this, I'm so like not able to do that in so many ways yet. I might be able to get there, but...
And I hope anybody who listens to this podcast doesn't think that we're just constantly giving advice because I think we're just... I think what is so great about, you know, our little back and forth that works is that we're just figuring it out.
Yeah.
And we're just taking our experiences of what went right and what went wrong and then putting it to audio.
And if anything of that is of use to anybody, then there's a glorious, glorious bonus.
Yeah. And yeah, people... I hope it helps. I mean, that's what I get from other podcasts. That's what I get from other sources of media and things I'm interested in, knowing that the struggle is real.
Yeah. I think today was the first time I could be wrong on this because we're always wrong, right? That's the point. And I know that I'm wrong to some degree, but today I just think the first time I explicitly made a suggestion about that onion theory of magic teaching. Like actually said, if you're teaching magic, I urge you to consider this. Like, I don't think we've ever said explicitly that before. Sure, we've implicitly talked about, hey, this might be a good way to think about stuff.
Or, yeah.
You know, being okay with failure is a good thing.
Yeah.
But it's different to going, you should do this. Here is a thing you should do to be better at something.
Yeah.
Because screw that.
Screw that, indeed.
Unless you've been asked for it, obviously.
Yeah, totally. Well, we got to let you get on your little airplane because it's going to take you 5 hours to get through TSA.
Yeah,
because
the government doesn't exist.
Hopefully,
right
when this
now.
Comes out, the government will still be running or start back up. We'll find out.
The USA will still exist.
I'm legit worried about it. It's funny how like you take those things and make them personal. You're like, well, I mean, if the TSA walks out, then I can't go to work.
Yeah.
When in reality, it's like, it's like but they're not being paid. You should be more concerned that they're not being paid.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, but if they don't do their job, then I can't do my job. And it's about me.
I love those concepts of a thing that the one that springs to mind is, I know there are other examples, but there's a Neal Stephenson novel called Snow Crash. It's very famous, very good. I loved it. Where the long story short, there's a thing where there's a thing that contains radioactive isotopes that's in basically a consumer product. And one character is going, oh, is this like properly contained? Like, you know, what if the containment's cracked? And they say, oh no, it's... And basically the line was to the effect of, if you ever find yourself in the presence of a force strong enough to crack that containment shell, the radiation is the least of your worries at that point. And I just love that sort of mindset of, yeah, like it's not impervious, but if something can get through that, then that thing is now the least of your worries compared to the thing that got through it, or the explosion that did that, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I like that, yeah.
Yep, just like the zombie apocalypse. It's not going to be the zombies we have to be worried about. It's the people. On that note...
Rule 1, cardio. Rule 2, double tap.
Exactly. Hey, thanks for listening. If you like us, give us a buck or two on Patreon.
Or tweet us or email us to let you know that you liked it. It's yeah. always nice to hear.
And, I mean, just the people coming up in person after shows is very nice, too. That's very kind of you.
And also, if you didn't like it, let us know as well. I mean, that was two episodes ago where people... It was the first time we really got some sort of critical feedback, mm-hmm. which was appreciated.
It wasn't even, like, negative. It was just like, a very good counterpoint to what you were making.
Yeah, if you have counterpoints, please. Like, as you've seen from... two episodes ago, like, we actively welcome those. That's useful because it helps us work out what we're wrong about. Mm-hmm. We know we're wrong about a lot of stuff, and finding out where it is and becoming asymptotically less wrong is a wonderful thing.
There you go. All right. Yeah. Have a nice day, everybody. Bye-bye.
Peace out.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcast. If you really like the show, you can donate a few bucks a month on our website, twomagiciansonemike.com, or become a monthly subscriber through our Patreon link. Thanks to all the people that support the show and keep it up and running. Be sure to follow us on the interwebs at @twomagiciansonemike. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.